The Iranian government and parliament were and remain standing beside Syria and President Assad. We in the parliament will ratify any draft resolution with regards to cooperation with Syria. We will give all permissions to the Iranian government to cooperate with Syria and help developing it.
The top legislator also met Syria's foreign minister, Faisal al-Maqdad, who called for enhancing economic relations for the benefit of the two nations, condemning unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and its Western allies on Syria and Iran. Nick Zad expressed Iran's willingness to increase the bulk of trade exchange and economic partnerships with Syria.
Strategic relations with Syria will never break. Iran will continue to support Syria in the reconstruction phase. We reject the U.S. unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, and Iran will spare no effort in assisting Syria in the fuel, economic, and trade sectors.
The Iranian lawmaker also held a meeting with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. Both officials underlined the importance of removing any obstacle in the face of implementing agreements signed between both states, as well as increasing the number of joint investment projects. The visit comes as a reiteration of the brotherly relations, not just between governments, but also the peoples of the two countries. The exchange of officials' visits between Syria and Iran recently increased with the aim of boosting economic cooperation. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The Saudi siege, a war crime and a genocide is the title of the seventh official report published by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights in the capital Sana'a. The report highlights the impact of the Saudi blockade on the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was clear in his speech when he said that we will not stand idly by and we will not allow this siege to continue to Saudi Arabia and its allies, that we will use our right to respond. Any country has to protect its citizens. Therefore, I believe that the coming days are fraught with surprises. Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen and prevents the entry of food, medicine, and fuel, and this is genocide.
Officials say the Saudi-led coalition has committed thousands of war crimes against Yemeni women and children during 7 years of war. They also say Riyadh's breach of international law is covered up politically by the United Nations.
We've entered the eighth year. The Saudi-led coalition is still committing war crimes against Yemenis, especially the siege, which takes more lives than air strikes. Public services, especially the health sector, have been greatly affected by the lack of fuel, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients. Unfortunately, the United Nations provides the political cover-up for the illegal acts of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. The United Nations describes war-torn Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but has taken no action to end this humanitarian catastrophe.
Observers say Saudi Arabia is still committing war crimes as it refuses to lift the siege on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of food and medicine and causing more lives, especially for patients, amid the collapse of the health sector and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
For 8 years, Donbas, a region of eastern Ukraine that did not accept the results of the Kyiv coup in 2014, has been under frequent shelling from national battalions and the armed forces of Ukraine. Residents of Donbas called it a war crime against the people, and from that moment Ukraine ceased to be a state in their eyes. According to Russian investigators, the actions of the Ukrainian military led to the deaths of more than 2,600 civilians, while more than 5,500 people were injured. 2,200 civilian infrastructure facilities were destroyed.
This is a town, school number 50 of the sadly known town of Gorlovka in the Donbas region, which is being shelled regularly.
The last time it was shelled by Ukrainian artillery on 24th of February. The teachers died on the spot. But one of the heaviest recent shellings, hushed up by the Western media, happened on March 14 in Donetsk. The Ukrainian military hit the center of the city with a Tochka-U tactical missile equipped with a cluster warhead. The rocket was shot down, but due to the fall of debris, 23 people died and 18 were injured.
The special operation of Russia is our opportunity to defend ourselves, the possibility that the Donbas will not be destroyed and hundreds of thousands of civilians will not be lost due to the Ukrainian aggression. We will be able to remain ourselves. We will be able to speak Russian, our native language, with which we were born and studied. We will have the right to relate to the history and results of the great patriotic war without manipulation. How grandfathers and great-grandfathers can be considered the winners against fascism and in no other way. Thanks to Russia's special operation, joy and hope for a just future appeared in the Donbas.
The ultimate goal of our republic is to hold a referendum in which the people exercise their constitutional right and express their opinion on joining the Russian Federation. I'm sure that's exactly what will happen. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Luhansk Republic have been living for 8 years under constant shelling and being in an economic and political blockade, experiencing the mockery and horrors of the Nazi battalions of Ukraine. They felt support only from the Russian Federation. With hope and a dream in our hearts, we are waiting for the opportunity to become part of the Russian Federation, to return, as they said in the Crimea, to our native harbour and start working on a great future.
The emotional answer of the head of the LPR to Press TV about holding a referendum on joining Russia caused a wide response. Later, he explained that the main task facing the leadership of the LPR now is the completion of hostilities. According to him, the battalions of Ukrainian nationalists are responsible for the murder, torture, robbery, and rape of civilians in Donbas. Most of them are relied on the experience of the commanders of the SS division during the World War II, and here in the settlement of Trehizbionka, still terrified. People did not believe in liberation and whispered about how they were bullied and subjected to violence. Here, the LPR servicemen found torture chambers with Nazi symbols hung up and the remains of those who simply disappeared from the village one day without a trace. The documents and an armaments depot were left by terrorist organization Right Sector. The LDPR military and people's militia say they collected documents about cases of cruelty against the population of Donbas and people from other regions of Ukraine. The documents include photos of people killed by bombing, runic symbols and signs of national battalions, facts of war crimes against humanity, and the positions of battalions in settlements with caches of weapons of mass destruction. Numerous residents of the recently liberated Volnovakha told Press TV that when the Russian forces entered their town, Ukrainian battalions left all the civilian property destroyed. Residents of the city were forbidden to evacuate, and looting had begun.
I am the chief physician of the Volnovakha District Hospital. This is what is left. This is our outpatient polyclinic building. We were in the basements. We all worked and provided assistance to the victims. Our employee died during a shelling from the Ukrainian side. Only on March 13, we were able to get out. There were heavy weapons of the Ukrainian forces on the territory of our hospital. All international conventions prohibit the presence of armed forces in civilian facilities. We asked them to leave the hospital many times and were told that they were given the order to destroy it during retreat.
In Lugansk, servicemen showed tanks and heavy weapons left by Ukrainian militants in the liberated cities and towns. All captured grenade launchers and ammunition, armored personnel carriers, tanks and grenade launchers are productions of the UK, US, Turkey and NATO countries. Donbas leaders and citizens emphasize that the ongoing military operation of Russia was only a response to the criminal acts of Kyiv against Donbas as a timely and preemptive measure. Today, Moscow says it has documents with proof that Kyiv was preparing a large-scale attack and intended to destroy the DNR and LNR.
Russia says its aim over the past months has been to target Ukrainian military infrastructure to prevent the enemy from regrouping and reinforcing its presence in the Donbas. It says it will press ahead with a strategy until the whole region is liberated. Marina Kartunova, Lugansk region.
The Iranian flag was hoisted high in Tehran on a day that's remembered as a milestone in Iran's history. April 1, 1979 was the day when the Islamic Republic replaced 3 millennia of monarchy in Iran. This came in a referendum held months after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that overthrew the former Pahlavi regime. The ballots contained yes or no to the Islamic Republic, and more than 98% of the eligible voters chose to vote yes.
April 1st is the Islamic Republic Day. It was a day when the monarchy gave way to democracy. We as Iranians honor this major occasion and celebrate it every year.
The Islamic Republic blessed Iran with independence and self-reliance. Today, Iran has its own industry and economy, which are not reliant on foreign countries.
The event also invited ambassadors to Iran, who took part to congratulate Iranians on the occasion.
We have a very long history of relationship with Iran, 119 years. Next year, we will be celebrating 120 years of diplomatic relations between our countries. So our relations have always been very good, sometimes closer, sometimes not so close. But in the last years, we have had very good relations, trade relations, political relations.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. Iranian officials say independence is one of the accomplishments brought about by the Islamic Republic in Iran.
43 years have passed since the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and well-wishers are trying to deal a blow to the establishment, but because we are an independent country in every sense of the world, enemies have not been able to harm our nation using sanctions and pressures.
Since its establishment, the Islamic Republic has faced many challenges, from the Western-funded Iraqi war to the stringent sanctions imposed against the country by the U.S. and Europe. Authorities of the Islamic Republic say the establishment has reached maturity in its fourth decade of life and will not surrender to Western pressures. The Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, and later was replaced by God's name, Allah, in the center, a reflection of the Iranians' Islamic beliefs, which they say were not addressed during the Shah era. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In the limelight. In Britain, a former top aide to Prime Minister Boris Johnson has accused Johnson of encouraging attacks on junior civil servants over the Partygate scandal in order to protect himself and his wife, Carrie. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Harry Taylor. The piece is titled Cummings accuses Prime Minister of encouraging attacks on junior staff over Number 10 parties. In Britain, Dominic Cummings, a former top aide to Boris Johnson, has accused Johnson of encouraging attacks on junior civil servants over the Partygate scandal in order to protect himself and his wife, Carrie. The Prime Minister's one-time senior aide said senior officials had turned a blind eye to his behaviour. He referred to briefing against one Number 10 private secretary, Hannah Young. It has emerged that her leaving party on 18th of June last year led to the first fines announced this week. Reports after some of the parties involving civil servants included a staff member breaking a swing in the garden belonging to Boris Johnson's son, Wilfred, a suitcase of alcohol being purchased from a nearby co-op store, and one staff member acting as a DJ. A total of 20 fixed penalty notices had been issued to staff who broke lockdown rules. Prime Minister Boris Johnson had previously told Parliament, when the allegations first came to light in November of 2021, that all guidance was followed completely at Number 10. In his latest blog, with an excerpt posted on Twitter, Dominic Cummings said, It is deeply, deeply contemptible that not just the Prime Minister, but senior civil servants have allowed such people to have their reputations attacked in order to protect the sociopathic, narcissistic squatting in the number 10 flat. Not just allowed, everybody at the centre of events also knows that the Prime Minister encouraged the media attacks on junior officials in order to divert the lobby's attention from him and Carrie breaking the law. Some very senior officials have turned a blind eye. Carrie is reported to have had parties in their Downing Street flat, while Boris had a surprise birthday party in 2020, attended by up to 30 staff, as well as the couple's interior designer, Lulu Little. Hannah Young did a truly phenomenal job and made us all safer during COVID and while coordinating a response to a terrorist incident, Dominic Cummings said. On Friday, 1st of April, officials in Downing Street started to get emails saying they were being fined £50 for attending parties, days after the Metropolitan Police confirmed they were handing out the notices. Detectives are investigating 12 events in 2020 and 2021, six of which Boris Johnson is said to have attended. The Metropolitan Police has said it has received more than 300 photographs and 500 pages of documents after a Whitehall inquiry by senior civil servant Sue Gray. In an appearance before a parliamentary select committee and in statements from his spokesperson after the fines this week, Boris Johnson refused to accept that the law had been broken. In response to a question from the Scottish National Party MP, Pete Wishart, during his Commons Liaison Committee session, Boris Johnson said, "I have been, I hope, very frank with the House about where I think we have gone wrong and the things that I regret and I apologise for, but there is an ongoing investigation. I understand the point you're making, but I have been very clear I won't give running commentary on an ongoing investigation." Dominic Cummings also criticised fines for junior officials over Boris Johnson's then principal private secretary, Martin Reynolds, despite having organised and attended a party in the cabinet secretary's office. Over the last few days, many junior officials have been fined for attending an event that the Prime Minister's principal private secretary organised. The principal private secretary was responsible for ensuring that events in number 10 were consistent not just with the rules but with the basic ethical standards. Number 10 Downing Street has been approached for comment.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Truce agreements why Saudi Arabia
and Yemen's Ansar Allah movement will finally see the lifting of the deadly siege on Yemen and an end to Saudi war after 7 years. According to the UN, the truce will last for 2 months. The hope is that this short-term ceasefire turns into a permanent one. It also comes on the backdrop of increasing Yemeni retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets and facilities deep inside the kingdom in a bid to break the Saudi siege. How much of a role did this play? On this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to discuss that and more with our guests. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War joining us from Hamilton. Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, joining us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Ken, if I could start with you, do you think this truce will stand, or will the Saudis violate it in a similar fashion that they violated the last truce announced in Sweden for the vital Yemeni port city of Hodeidah?
Well, we all hope that the truce will stand and that it will turn into a permanent ceasefire and lead to an end of hostilities and the whole war, the whole Saudi-U.S. war on Yemen. The last truce that was announced in Sweden did not stand, and that was because, and the Saudis violated it at will, and they knew they could get away with it because they had the unconditional backing of the U.S. and the U.K., and they went ahead and they blocked the humanitarian supplies, which meant that the children of Yemen did not get the necessary food and medicines that they needed, and they continued to die at the rate of one every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF. But things have changed now. The Saudis no longer have the same relationship with the U.S. and the U.K. Things have changed in the Middle East since last August when the U.S. withdrew in a chaotic fashion in a debacle in Afghanistan. And things have changed again with the conflict in Ukraine and the calls that were made, the panicked calls that were made by President Biden to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE, which were not answered by the phone was not picked up in Saudi Arabia or the UAE to answer the call to increase oil production to make up for what the West, including Canada, have done in sanctioning Russian oil and natural gas and trying to isolate Russia from the world economic system. So there's been a change in the power relations, and I think that the Saudis may this time honor the truce that they've signed, and hopefully it will lead to a permanent ceasefire, because it's now, last weekend was the 7th year of this war, and we had demonstrations across the country in Canada, and we had an online rally a couple of nights ago. And we know that there is huge dissatisfaction in Canada with the war in Yemen because Canada is selling arms to Saudi Arabia.
Indeed, interesting. Kevin, what does it show? What does this show about the facts on the ground after 7 years, as Ken pointed out, of Saudi Arabia waging war on Yemen and imposing a deadly all-out blockade on its neighbor?
Yes, well, I agree with what we just heard from Ken. A lot of things have changed, and along with the change in this geostrategic situation, as you're suggesting, things, the facts on the ground are changing as well. The Yemenis have shown the ability to hit targets in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and I think that has leveled the playing field a little bit. Up until now, the Saudis and the Emiratis have been able to operate with complete impunity. They've been bombing Yemen to smithereens, mostly killing civilians, something approaching toward 400,000 civilians have died now from this ongoing war after 7 years, and they've gotten away with it. They haven't suffered much themselves, aside from the humiliation of being one of the world's most heavily armed forces that is getting defeated by a vastly smaller and less funded and less armed force. But in terms of tangible problems, tangible defeats and economic pain and things like that, the Saudis and Emiratis haven't paid a price. And as Ken said, the imperialists have actually been cheering them on and encouraging them. So now the two things that have changed are, one, the geostrategic situation, where the Saudis and Emiratis seem to be no longer on the short leash of the empire. They're not taking the calls of the President of the United States. That's a first. And on the ground, the Yemenis are firing these missiles that are getting through their targets and hitting Saudi oil installations, and not only damaging the oil industry, but more importantly, harming Saudi's reputation and slowing down the tourism, and basically giving Saudi Arabia at least a symbolic black eye. It's nothing like the suffering that's happening
in Yemen. Kevin, hold on to that thought for just a moment, and let me get back to Ken. Ken, do you see a turn of the tide against the Saudis with Yemen's retaliatory attacks targeting Riyadh's energy, military, and economy?
I couldn't agree more with the question, the sentiment of the question, and the comments by the other guest, my colleague Kevin Barrett. I was so impressed over the last 7 years by the courage and dedication, selflessness of the Yemeni fighters. At the beginning of this conflict, I remember seeing pictures of Yemeni soldiers in bare feet going out to take on the light armored vehicles made in Canada and sold by the Canadian government to the Saudi forces, and defeating them, capturing large numbers of Saudi coalition troops. But over the years, the Houthi forces have managed to arm themselves even better and make these retaliatory attacks with sophisticated missiles and drones, and down the drones of the Saudis and the Emiratis. So they have come a long way in 7 years, and they have demonstrated that they are gaining the upper hand militarily.
Right, so here's the point. Pardon me, Ken, if I could just switch back to Kevin. Kevin, you know, after more than 7 years of indiscriminate airstrikes by the Saudis with the most advanced weapons, let's not forget the Saudis did put their faith in hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons from, as Ken says, Canada, but in particular the United States, whereas the Yemenis built indigenous weapons and essentially put their faith in God.
That's right. And it's fitting that this truce would happen at the beginning of Ramadan, which it just started today here in the United States. And it is indeed a Ramadan truce. And there is a history and a whole culture of peacemaking around Ramadan in Islamic culture. And it's true that the Yemenis have demonstrated that kind of faith in defending a just cause that has religious justification, not only in Islam, but in other great religious traditions, and indeed in international law and in philosophical just war ethics. I mean, they're defending themselves against a vastly more powerful aggressor, and they've shown great dedication and determination and courage in doing that. So I agree completely with what Ken said about that. And I would add that this is a wake-up call to the other Islamic countries who are now seeing a new world in which the empire that has dominated them and divided and conquered them for so long and robbed their resources is now reeling and maybe about to fall. And what, you know, where do we go from here? Well, let's get back to our authentic Islamic tradition and ethics, and let's try to make peace between our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters.
Right. Ken, I mean, did the Saudis lose the hearts and the minds of the global public opinion when more and more footage emerged of where these Saudi airstrikes were hitting and who these Saudi airstrikes were hitting and killing?
Absolutely. The Saudis did lose the war for public opinion, our world public opinion. They lost it wherever it was able to be shown. However, we have to keep in mind that at least in the West, the news, the atrocities, the pictures of the destruction, the facts and figures about the Saudi atrocities and war crimes committed in Yemen were hidden from the people. The mainstream media hardly gave them an inch of coverage in the press, hardly ever on TV. It was always about other issues around the world where the United States and Canada had bigger fish to fry. So I would say that, yes, the Saudis continued to lose global public opinion, especially over other issues like the execution recently of 81 people, head chopping, public head chopping, the assassination of the U.S. Journalist Khashoggi, and other issues such as those. But overall, I think that the Saudi war, the Saudi-U.S. war on Yemen, was mainly hidden from the public in the West.
Well, on that point, let me segue to Kevin. Kevin, the question here is, there have been many accusations of hypocrisy and double standards from the Western governments and Western media alike towards, for example, Ukraine in comparison with Yemen. The conflict in the unfortunate conflict in Ukraine has not lasted 40 days yet. The war on Yemen, more than 7 years, and with too many UN reports highlighting Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. How many Yemeni children are suffering as we speak right now from malnutrition? How many Yemeni children as we speak right now are starving to death? Where is the coverage in the Western media? Where is the sanctions against those who are bombing Yemen and imposing the blockade?
Yes, that's right. There has it's true that in a sense the Saudis lost the global battle for public opinion, but they really didn't lose very much because, as we heard, they didn't. It's never really been covered. The overall amount of coverage of the Ukraine war, for example, is it's got to be by many, many orders of magnitude beyond what we've seen in terms of the coverage of the Yemen war. So 7 years worth of coverage of the war in Yemen is probably a small fraction of what we've seen just in this month and a half of war in Ukraine. And it certainly looks like racism in the way that the Western media plays up the suffering of people in Ukraine and largely ignores the vastly greater suffering in Yemen. I think it's partly racism. It's also probably partly the imperial geostrategy that the empire wants the people to be angry with Russia. So every last drop of suffering in Ukraine will be milked and exploited as much as possible, while the empire has sided with the perpetrators in this war on Yemen. So there's tremendous hypocrisy, but that's all part of the game plan because it's, you know, it's an empire. So these are not democratic humanitarian countries. These countries are ruled by a ruthless oligarchical empire that's bent on expansion. And it's this is really the empire's war on Yemen, probably as much as it is the Saudis and Emiratis' war on Yemen. And so their propaganda apparatus has waged that war really by staying out of it. They couldn't really win it, so they just didn't cover it. Whereas in the Ukraine, propaganda apparatus is working full-time, overtime, doing the work of many brigades. So we just have to remember that the Western media is not free. It's just part of an imperial propaganda ministry.
Okay, so I mean, so is it the case then with the West that if it's your ally waging war, then it's a good war, and if it's not your ally, then it's a bad war.
That is indeed the case. There is a huge double standard in the West when it comes to wars of the empire versus wars against the empire. The war in Yemen, as your other guest said very clearly, is a war of the U.S. empire. What the U.S. and its allies want to do in Yemen is the same as the British tried to do for the last 100 years previously, and that is to secure the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb on which Yemen sits and make sure they have control of the navigation through the Suez Canal. It's a strategic choke point in the world, and the U.S. wanted to maintain that choke point. And the U.S. was also, and so was Saudi Arabia, concerned with a rival that they saw in China with its Belt and Road Initiative, which is going to come right across the Arabian Peninsula and link China with Africa and Europe in an economic sphere of influence which would be beneficial for all, and which the Ansarallah movement has already said it wanted to join. But, of course, the U.S. doesn't want that, didn't want that to happen, doesn't want it to happen, and neither does Saudi Arabia, which prefers instead to try and create a trade route north and south through the Arabian Peninsula, down into Africa and up to Turkey. So this was a huge geopolitical struggle that the U.S. is not winning and probably will not win. And they did not cover it in the same way as the war that took place in Ukraine, which they were turning into a de facto NATO state under Mr. Zelensky and waging a war against the Russian-speaking people in the east of the Ukraine called the Donbass. And when the Russian government reacted, as it would, had no choice, as it was pushed in the corner over 30 years of expansion of NATO, the mainstream media in the West went wild against Russia. Demonizing everything Russian. You can't play hockey in this country unless you're a Russian player, unless you swear allegiance, unless you condemn Russia. You can't play Tchaikovsky. You can't dance in a ballet, that's written by a Russian. It's something we haven't seen since 9/11, the intensity of it. So there is a huge double standard in the West when it comes to wars. It was exemplified to me in a cartoon which I put on our Facebook page, on which Western leaders are standing on a mountain of dead corpses, bloody corpses of victims of their wars in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and they're pointing their fingers toward Russia in this cartoon and saying, "Putin bad, bad, bad." It's a huge hypocrisy.
Right. Kevin, I want to ask you about NATO's complicity here in Saudi war crimes committed in Yemen. How complicit is it? How complicit is the West, in particular the United States? We all saw the remnants of the bomb marked Made in America that killed some 40 Yemeni school children in a school bus. And this is American intelligence, at the end of the day, on which targets to hit in Yemen.
Yes, NATO and the U.S., which is, of course, the master of NATO. NATO is really a euphemism for the U.S. occupation of Europe and now for the extension, or the attempted extension of the U.S. empire around the world. And so the U.S. and NATO have been arming, funding, training, guiding, advising the Saudi forces as they bomb Yemen. So, yeah, absolutely. NATO and the U.S. are 100% complicit. And this really illustrates how public opinion in the U.S. doesn't matter. As we've heard, the Saudis did not win U.S. Western public opinion on this war ever. And Biden had to promise to stop this support for the Saudis while he was running for president. But once he became president, he just obeyed the real masters, who are the folks in the National Security Council and the other strategists, the permanent deep state, who control the shadow government and direct the policy of the empire, regardless of which politician is in office. And those people are the ones who probably helped orchestrate this war in the first place. And the U.S. has been not just selling military equipment and making a tidy profit at it, but also overseeing its use and training people on it and guiding the targets and so on. The same sorts of things that they're doing with in Ukraine, and they've done with the Ukrainian military, which provoked the Russians into doing what they did. So this empire, again, it's not democratically run. It's not really run by the politicians. They're just figureheads and frontmen, and it is completely complicit in these atrocities.
Kent, war crimes were not just committed by Saudi Arabia as human rights organizations and UN organizations or agencies have documented, but also by its Western backers, especially with Washington's intelligence. Will they be held accountable?
Sadly, not. The Western European empires have been going around the world committing war crimes, ethnic cleansing, mass murders, slavery, for 400 or 500 years now and getting away with it. They have never, ever been held accountable for any of their crimes over the centuries. Today, the legal processes of the UN, and we have seen at The Hague, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, and we have also seen the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. These are bought and paid for by funding from Canada, the U.S., and EU countries. And what they are used for is never to prosecute the imperial countries such as the U.S. or France or Canada alongside the U.S. In their activities around the world, but rather to prosecute the people who are on the losing end of these wars, African leaders, Rwandan Hutu leaders, the former leader of the Yugoslavia, Mr. Slobodan Milosevic. So since they control these legal mechanisms, and since the U.S. has, and Israel, which, by the way, we haven't mentioned, is occupying with the UAE, the Yemeni island of Socotra, they have exempted themselves from these legal mechanisms, so they cannot be prosecuted anyway. So the shorter answer is they will not be held accountable.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario, and also Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, who joined us from Madison, Wisconsin. And that brings an end to another edition of the Spotlight.
In the Limelight. This sharp jump in COVID-19 case numbers is being driven by the virus variant BA2, which is even more transmissible than the original Omicron version,
that swept Britain at the beginning of the year. We're prepared for you an article written by Robin McKee. The piece is titled UK COVID cases at an all-time high, free testing scrapped. So what will happen now? It was estimated recently that almost 5 million people in the United Kingdom are now believed to have COVID-19, an all-time high figure for the disease which first struck the nation 2 years ago. Scientists added hospital admissions and deaths are also rising, but not nearly so sharply. This sharp jump in case numbers is being driven by the virus variant BA2, which is even more transmissible than the original Omicron version that swept Britain at the beginning of the year. The latest wave comes just as the government has ended free testing for the virus and as the nation prepares to enjoy its Easter holidays. This prospect raises the fear that further increases in case numbers, followed by rises in hospital admissions and deaths, could afflict the United Kingdom. But as other researchers have pointed out, spring has arrived and warmer weather will allow more and more people to mix out of doors, where they are less likely to infect each other. In short, the outcome is unclear. So what is the likely trajectory of the disease for the rest of the year? And what key measures should be taken now to limit the spread of COVID-19? Should mask-wearing regulations remain strict? Professor Paul Hunter of the University of East Anglia says, "I don't think so, unless you're someone who is particularly vulnerable." The latest Office of National Statistics Characteristics Survey doesn't find much benefit of mask wearing anymore, though that does not mean that face masks don't work. It is probably just that people who haven't been wearing face masks are more likely to have had the infection already, and so are less susceptible. This point was backed by Professor Roland Keogh of Edinburgh University. Professor Keogh said, "With all other restrictions pretty much removed, we have very little evidence that cloth masks, such as commonly worn, have much effectiveness against the Omicron variant due to its higher transmissibility." However, the vaccine expert Peter English argues that mask wearing still has an important role to play in limiting the spread of COVID. Peter English says masks are particularly effective for source control, at preventing an infectious person from infecting others. And there are people who remain in high risk from COVID-19. They cannot protect themselves as well as they need to by wearing a face mask themselves. They rely on others to protect them by masking up in enclosed public spaces. Can Britons expect UK infections to peak soon? Professor Sheila Bird of Cambridge University says, "Yes, with respect to Omicron BA2, it will probably peak in the next couple of weeks in England and Wales, to be followed in 2 to 3 weeks in terms of consequent COVID-mentioned deaths." Professor Paul Hunter of University of East Anglia says, "In fact, infections may have peaked already. My best guess is that they peaked around 21st of March, but given that the Office of National Statistics Survey is a prevalence survey and always published a week behind, we should not expect to see falling Office of National Statistics estimates until next week at the earliest, and probably not until the following Friday, 8th of April. However, Professor Keogh added, "The picture is likely to be confusing." He said, "As testing goes down and surveillance is slowed or stopped, it will become very difficult to tell for sure." Britain's likely to get a COVID-free summer. Virologist Julian Tang of Leicester University says, no, COVID-19 will persist throughout summer and into autumn. It has not become fully seasonal yet, unlike the flu, which does disappear almost completely throughout spring and summer. He added the seasonal behavior of flu also contrasts with those common colds that are caused by coronaviruses and which persist all year round, albeit at relatively low levels, but with peaks in autumn and winter. This point was backed by Professor Hunter. He said, even in the absence of a new variant, I suspect we will continue to see infections at a rate of a few tens of thousands a day, but most won't be diagnosed and recorded. He added, we're only diagnosing about 1 in 7 to 1 in 8 new infections now, and this may drop. However, the rate of hospitalizations per infection is lower than at any time and does seem to be continuing to fall, so hopefully we won't see many COVID-19 hospitalizations during summer. Professor Keo also warned that infection numbers were also likely to remain high. He said, we have to remember that for the bulk of people vaccinated last autumn, there will be a substantial drop in immune protection unless all adults are offered booster shots. This combination means that it is likely that there will remain considerable Omicron infections circulating, though we will expect the overall level to drop compared to now. What direction should vaccine development take to protect Britons against future rises in cases and new variants? A range of improvements in vaccines was highlighted by Peter English, who pinpointed several key areas when efforts should be directed. He told The Observer, current vaccines are very effective at preventing serious illness, but if we are to prevent transmission, we need vaccines which are more effective in preventing transmission. Ideally, we would also have vaccines which induce longer-lasting immunity. In addition, it will be helpful to develop new methods of vaccine administration, such as nasal sprays and vaccines that have been updated to match circulating variants, as well as COVID-19 vaccines which can be given in combination with flu vaccines. Peter English added, we may well require an annual vaccination against COVID-19 due to waning immunity, just as we do for influenza. It would make a lot of sense to combine the two in a single annual jab.